You have a severe imbalance in your brain chemistry. If it gets much worse, it could become life-threatening. Now, I need to know how Vulcans deal with this condition.
We go home. Every 7 years of our adult life, Vulcans experience an instinctual, irresistible urge to return to the homeworld and take a mate.
Transfer complete.
Welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, throwing a soup out of his bedroom.
Again?
Again.
Didn't this happen like 7 years ago?
Yeah, and I feel like it's going to happen another 7 years, Cam.
Oh, dear. Well, this week, we are going to talk about fixing the Ponfar problem.
There's Ponfar, and it has a problem that needs fixing, Cam?
I feel like when you're covered in sweat and raging inside, there might be a problem.
There might be a problem, okay.
Yeah.
Maybe let's give listeners a little bit of background here, because we actually originally wanted to do this as a Valentine's Day episode. Just kind of as like a funny joke. We're like, You know what, Ponfar, it's a little lighthearted sort of thing. And then we realize, well, you know, Discovery's probably going to be on for Valentine's Day. So let's just get it out of the way here.
Right.
And I think you and I,
we thought President's Day was inappropriate.
Yeah, obviously. So we did our research and then we realized there's a lot of these like threads and a lot of stuff being depicted where you and I were like, there's right. a lot of problems with, you know, Ponfar in how it represents male sexuality and a lot of male dominance over women, and when it comes to sexuality, that it couldn't really be such a lighthearted, like, sure. you know, thing that we wanted to do. But we also didn't want to sit here and pick apart such an iconic part of Star Trek to the point where, like, nobody's going to enjoy listening to what we have to sure. say because it's so problematic. I think what we want to do is kind of address, like, the interesting things that it has to share about culture, and then maybe also address some of the problematic things that I think are very much of the era and wouldn't necessarily be on display by the writers in the New Discovery era. And
sure.
This will actually be kind of an interesting discussion, and one that, I swear to God, it's not going to feel like homework having to listen to us beg on Ponfar.
Definitely not. I mean, we totally know that, like, Ponfar is a huge joke with fans, and we find a lot of the jokes funny
sure.
here at cons.
Yeah.
You know, celebs love making jokes about it on stage, and they even have, like, was it the men's cologne named Ponfar? Believe me, I get it more than anyone. Like,
there's the cologne?
A cologne.
Yeah,
I bathe in it nightly.
I was wondering what I was smelling when you came into the studio.
I've gone broke buying bottles of it. But, you know, it's like, there's some really great Ponfar episodes, but there's a lot of episodes that, yeah, it's like you walk out of them going, like, I don't know that this story supports this initial premise. And, like, I think the initial premise may be flawed in that it was imagined at a specific time and hasn't essentially evolved or been updated in a way that maybe speaks to furthering generations of Star Trek fans in a way that has maybe the meaning that you get originally.
It'll be clear as we give our examples, but I think essentially what happens here is Star Trek is, by its nature, a very progressive series, but it was made in an era that progress still needed to be made. And
sure.
when you're watching a lot of stuff, you're like, if the Vulcans represent a Federation species that is progressive, you're trying to, I guess, square the peg that needs to be a little bit fixed here.
Right.
It's an issue. So why don't we get into it? The most iconic Ponfar of all, let's go with the Mock Time Cam, where
right.
We're introduced to this through, I guess, like, very vague symptoms of what the doctor's calling nervousness on the part of Spock. And it evolves into something that's a lot of rage going on, as I alluded
yeah.
to with the soup thing. But as a point of view where Spock is discussing how it's almost like salmon have to go back to the very stream
sure.
that they spawned, I'm fascinated by this, I guess, biological urge about Vulcan males needing to go back to their home planet to proceed with this particular mating ritual.
Well, what I really like about the way this episode essentially introduces this premise is the fact that you have Kirk as the outsider, which is us. We are that person playing the Kirk role in the room listening to Spock, trying to be sensitive because we love this character. and taking in the information and trying to be respectful and understand where he's coming from. Like, I like that the show isn't taking, like, that snickering attitude towards that I think almost any other show would. And I thought it was really weird. I was doing research for this episode, and, like, the studio loved this episode. They wanted it in season one. Mm. And the writer, Theodore Sturgeon, notoriously worked, like, he was quite slow. And so ended up getting bumped to season two. But the fact that, like, the studio was really pushing for this episode, too, is really interesting to me. Because to me, this feels like an episode that, if it were to come out now, I don't think the studio would be like, we need that episode now. They'd be like, guys, do we need this one, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think you bring up the great point, or the fact that there's not, they don't make a joke out of it.
Yes.
And I think this is very important, and it's revelatory for our understanding of the Vulcans, where you do not even talk about Ponfar amongst yourselves. It is something that is so incredibly private. Like, I don't even think we could imagine kind of the equivalent sort of thing about privacy here in our own culture, which is kind of fascinating to understand. And, you know, gives you some insight into maybe Spock's sex life to a certain degree.
Sure, yeah.
But for this, though, I mean, there are things that are a little eyebrow raising.
Sure.
In that he starts using Christine Chapel's first name, but he knows how she feels about Spock. Despite his, you know, very cold exterior, he's been able to pick up nuances from her and understand that she has always been interested in him. And this condition is, it's presented as something that is so serious that he's actually willing to, I guess, consider relations between the two of them.
Right.
In a way, I don't know, does it seem as if Spock would be taking advantage of Christine Chapel's own feelings in order to satisfy these biological urges?
I mean, in any other episode, no. In a case like this, where there is like a neural effect, maybe. I mean, I like...
Maybe. So there's a possibility he's not taking advantage of her?
Here's the thing. I don't think he is in this episode. I never got the sense that, like, Spock was considering Christine Chapel to fulfill that purpose. No. I mean, she's
So when he was calling her by her first name and speaking to her in a far more intimate way, what was the intention behind that?
I thought it was more that Spock was essentially becoming a little more imbalanced and less controlled in his emotions and behaving just unusually warm towards people. Like, that's a thing you see in other episodes. We'll see characters, like Vulcan characters, begin to say, like, laugh or smile. And to me, it's more like Spock, who always keeps that very stoic demeanor, is kind of dropping that. And it's more of a warning sign that something's off with Spock.
Why did he ask her for soup?
Because he likes soup, obviously.
Okay.
Did he want the soup, or did she just bring him the soup?
No, he wanted the soup.
Then why'd he throw it into the hallway?
That was another time. So she brings him the soup during the teaser.
Okay, that's the time
I'm
thinking.
And then he starts saying, you know, hey, I know you have feelings for me. And then she's like, call me Christine. It's like, I know your name is Christine. Can you make me some soup now?
Right. I mean...
So you don't think that he had any interest in her whatsoever?
I never got the sense that he did really know. Like, I'm being honest, like, I never got the sense that, like, he had salacious motives towards her based on his condition. No.
Okay. I mean, to me, I thought it was, like, crystal clear that's what was going on here, but different interpretations. So for you, the interpretation wasn't that Spock had any interest whatsoever in pursuing Chapel as a mate. It was just that Ponfar is making him lose control of whatever feelings that he had.
Right. Well, I mean, Nimoy has talked a lot about how, to him, Spock was a character who felt everything. Like, it was more that he learned to not essentially exhibit the emotions, like they were buried within him. And to me, the way I was interpreted the Ponfar was that, I mean, aside from the obvious things we'll get to later, but was that it essentially puts cracks in that facade. And one of the big jokes of Star Trek is whenever you see Spock smiling, something bad is about to happen. Like, to me, it's more like when he starts behaving inappropriately or not the way we think of as Spock, it's more like this Ponfar has affected his ability to moderate the way he would control himself or carry himself in day-to-day life. So, like, I totally get where you're coming from with the Chapel stuff. It's weird, though. Maybe because it doesn't jump out to me, because the original series in general is not particularly subtle when it has characters behaving very salaciously or grossly. Like, you know, you can look at a lot of episodes where there's, like, The Enemy Within, for example, with, you know, bad Kirk towards Yeoman Rand, or elements like that, or Gamesters of Triskelion. Mm-hmm. So I guess to me, no, I never looked at that as, like, Spock having really, like, subtle, insidious motives towards Nurse Chapel. Okay. It was more that he was not well and was essentially uncharacteristically allowing her more access to him because he's just not able to hold up that exterior.
Okay. I guess, you know, different interpretations. Anyways, and they end up on this planet, and they have what I think is probably the most problematic issue here, is that it's all about conquering of a woman, T'Pring, Spock's wife here.
Mm-hmm.
And they make it even very clear, T'Pau is explaining that whoever the victor here takes possession of T'Pring.
Right.
For me, let's say we can go back in time and rethink how they approach this. How would we approach something like this? Because there's no way, if Star Trek Discovery ever presents Ponfar,
sure,
we're going to have a plot thread where a man takes possession of a woman.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's tough because I understand in the original series what they're going for. There is a little bit of that sort of romantic ideal of like the duel for a woman's hand. That is essentially what is taking place here. But they're trying to filter it through a progressive Vulcan society. And I think they try to undercut it in ways where they make T'Pring a very headstrong and tough character who's trying to manipulate the situation in a sense.
Well, she even breaks it down at the end, like, here is my explanation for what I wanted.
Yes.
And what Stahn wanted and how we were going to accomplish that.
Yes. And she chooses Kirk because she knows that's the only way to get the outcome she wants.
So does she maybe have a lot more agency than it would initially appear then?
I think so. And I think the reason this episode does work as well as it does is because we don't look at T'Pring as like a victim of circumstance. Like T'Pring seems to be the one playing the odds the best of anyone. But it does, again, raise the question, as you know, you're implying there, where it's like, are all female Vulcans like this? Like, what about the female Vulcan who isn't necessarily as forward thinking and as aggressive in her choices as T'Pring? It then raises more complications of like, well, is this a scenario that makes sense? And again, you know, Star Trek, of course, puts us in that place of where Kirk is, where we're not supposed to judge the other culture, right? Like, it's their customs. Who are we to judge it? But in terms of a storytelling device where you are speaking to millions of Earthlings and communicating these messages to kids watching TV, it does become problematic.
But this, I think, is more to the issue, though, is because if we're looking at the Federation as a progressive society, and one of the founding members of the Federation literally has a culture where you take possession of a woman, they use the words take possession, that fundamentally makes us think of Vulcan society as retrograde. And I'm wondering how we rethink that. How do we fix that, you know, with regards to this possession idea that they have in their society? And you know, and I think it's not just enough to say, hey, Discovery writers, and we're all just using Discovery as an example.
Sure, whatever future Trek series wants to handle this.
Yeah, but hey, Discovery writers, just don't, why don't you just forget about it? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm wondering if there could be even like subcultures within Vulcan, and maybe this is just one of those kind of offshoots that didn't quite make it mainstream, and we just happened to be one of those weird little offshoots that we were watching in Amok time.
There's also a problematic element with the whole idea of this duel, and that it very much creates this link between sex and death, or sex and violence. And to me, that is actually an issue that also causes a lot of problems. In that, as a storytelling device that I think fans take as a lot of fun. And I think Amok Time is just a blast of an episode. It's one of my favorites of the original series. I don't think there's anything wrong with fans loving that episode. I think it's fantastic. But it does introduce this concept of, like, you know, ultimately, like, Spock is purged of the Ponfar through violence.
Yes.
And so you're now creating this Vulcan element where, I mean, I get it, because they repress everything. It's this extreme sort of unleashing of whatever buried energy they have within them, but it becomes uncomfortable because we don't want to necessarily correlate the Vulcan mating procedures with violence.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I know that's kind of one of the jokes with the Klingon society, and we'll get to them later, but you know, I know that's like a joke ongoing in like DS9, for example, with Jadzia and Worf's romance. But with the Vulcans, it becomes a little more head scratching. because we don't necessarily look at the Vulcans that way. And I guess this is sort of like the crack in their society.
Is it a remnant of what their culture was thousands of years ago before they underwent this big philosophical change?
Well, it very much could be, because ultimately sex is like the primary biological imperative, right? So it would make sense that like you can fix everything. You can fix the way your society looks, the way your, you know, teachers instruct students, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that biological imperative is always going to be there. Is that sort of the problem with Vulcans? Does that open up, like, maybe that's one of the primary issues with their society?
Yeah, very much so. And that's, I thought of it, that violence aspect is more like bucks going at it with their horns
sure.
to a certain degree. And because, you know what, a ponfar doesn't actually mean death in the vast majority of these cases.
Right.
So you've got that, but it is the extreme unleashing of emotions that it, whether, you know, it's violence in Spock's case, or I guess just orgasmic euphoria.
Sure.
In the case of, I guess, what will be Staun and T'Pring later on.
Right.
So,
or sometimes it appears to just be more of like a psychic link moment too.
Yeah, and I wonder
in some of the cases we'll get to coming up.
And I wonder if maybe it hadn't been that thought out at the time that Amok Time came out, but I do like the idea of maybe kind of this intense psychic intimacy that Ponfar could represent as well. Any final thoughts on what Ponfar, as it's represented, kind of means to you with regards to Amok Time, Cam?
With me, in terms of Amok Time, it introduces an element to the Vulcans that I think is really interesting and adds a huge amount to the mythology of them. I think it's a fascinating concept because the writers could have done something really simple or really cheesy that would have been dated in a way. Like, we can argue whether or not the gender politics of Amok Time are problematic. But in terms of introducing, like, a sexual component to the Vulcans, it does it in a way that I think shows more attempt on their part to be thoughtful and to try and come up with something original and interesting than to just make it, like, kind of a really crude sexual episode that would have been dated in a week.
I could have just imagined how bad this one could have gone, and the very fact that it's endured, especially among the fan base, I mean, despite the problems that we've identified here, how it depicts male sexual dominance over women, it is something that is trying to really showcase something very primal about this very button-down culture, which is interesting. And you did bring up the fact that maybe this Ponfar effect that it had on Spock, it made him bring down barriers. Do we want to talk about maybe one of the most iconic moments here with the, like, Jim exclamation came out? Do you think that is genuine on the part of Spock, or is he still kind of suffering the after effects of Ponfar at that very moment? Well, how is your interpretation?
To me, it was always, he's still in that sort of fragile state.
Yeah.
Like, he's got to recuperate. Like, I don't get the sense, like, Ponfar, like, the immediate moment of, you know, sex or whatever, psychic link or violence, I guess, in this case, I don't feel like it's an instant snap your fingers and they're back to normal. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like there would be a little bit of a recovery period.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, one thing I want to say about this episode, though, is, like, you know, we can look at other episodes of the original series that have more, I think, more significant problems, like Turnabout Intruder or Enemy Within. But what I think makes Amok Time still work is how it is very respectful. Like, we can argue about how dated the way that it deals with this issue is, but I feel like it's very respectful to all the characters involved with it, and that the writers never feel like they are taking cheap shots or taking away the dignity of the characters.
Sure, yeah. And by respect, primarily about, I guess, what Spock is going through.
Yes.
Right, okay. Yeah.
And ultimately, the characters all kind of get what they want.
That's true.
Even old Staun, who to me, is it eerie, or does he look exactly like Harrison Ford?
I did not pick up on that.
Really? It haunts me. Like, every time I see him, I'm like, it looks like 1960s, like, Harrison Ford stepping in for a TV role.
Okay. No.
Oh, okay. It was funny, though. I saw a little bit of trivia note that in West Germany in the 60s, they edited out all references to this being anything to do with reproduction.
So what was the episode about?
It was, like, basically the episode translation in German was Space Fever. And it was written as a lethal disease. And all of the elements on Vulcan at the end, all everything to do with the duel and everything, was rewritten in the, I guess, the dubbing or the subtitles or whatever, as hallucinations.
Okay.
I would love to see a bootleg of that.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. Yeah. Why don't we make our own?
Yeah. Who's to say I haven't?
I don't want to know about any bootleg Pon Far videos you've been making on your own cam. Yeah. Why don't we jump on over to that, I think, the next big one. We may have had references to Pon Far here and there, and maybe we can talk about one of the movies at the very end of this show.
But sure.
I think Voyager's Blood Fever in Season 3 is the next big one, which, of course, we have Tarek come up to... Vorik.
Yeah, no, you're permitted for making that mistake.
Yeah, Vorik, same actor, same species.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Didn't want to pay the writer.
But Vorik approaches B'Elanna and says, let's become mates.
Yeah.
And B'Elanna's way too polite by just not outright saying, well, wait a minute, no.
People are a little more polite in the 24th century, yeah, I guess.
She humored him far longer before she firmly said no.
Which is really interesting coming from B'Elanna Torres, who's known to be quite fiery.
Yeah. And then his response was to physically assault the woman who told him no.
Yeah.
This, to me, we're already about 3 minutes into the episode, and I'm like, oh boy.
We're in for a wild ride, yeah.
Yeah. So, going from there, I mean, obviously, this Pon Far psychic link that we kind of talked about in the last one, it's transferred over to B'Elanna. She's essentially got this neurochemical imbalance that is actually threatening her life.
Right.
And she ends up quite peppy at the very beginning.
Yeah.
Which I found very fascinating.
She's like, we gotta go climbing, guys. We gotta go climbing.
I still don't think that the full effects have been swept over her by the time she's screaming at Neelix. I just think that's how she would have reacted, you know, screaming at Neelix there.
Yeah.
But look.
You don't want to see her with Neelix when she's got Pon Far. Then the screaming really is going. Yeah. rage. Neelix wouldn't have made it off that planet.
I don't think so. I think she would have broken his other leg. But before we get into the Tom and B'Elanna stuff, why don't we talk a little bit about what's going on the ship? Because we actually have the doctor talking to Tuvok about it. And he, again, if we're approaching it from what this reveals about Vulcan culture, Tuvok makes it very clear that he does not want to talk about it. He doesn't really want to help out Vorik. It's not something that he believes he should have any input on as well. And the doctor has a very good remark with, like, well, you guys are very Victorian about your sex lives, aren't
sure.
you? Yeah, so...
Not like the other Star Trek characters.
No, not at all. So, but with this... Do you buy into, I guess, what the doctor was initially proposing? Did you ever think that this hologram would actually cure the fever, Cam?
Well, I guess this is where it gets a little confusing, because the breaking of Pon Far, while in, I think, most fans' mind is inherently sexual, is often portrayed as anything but on the show. And so I'm like, I don't know, maybe. Like, I don't really know. Like, I feel like the specific rules of how to break the Pon Far fever are a little bit fuzzy, just fuzzy enough that when I'm watching the show, I'm like, I guess that would work, maybe. Okay.
Well, because Tuvok does say that there's three methods.
Yeah.
Taking a mate.
Yes.
Ritual combat.
Yeah.
Or else intensive meditation.
Sure.
Which one would you choose?
Well, obviously, intensive meditation.
Okay, yeah. I figure that much. Yeah. So I was also very skeptical that... meditating really, really hard would cure him of Pon Far.
Well, to me, that one feels more denial. Like, you know, I don't think the meditation ever really worked. I have a question for you, though. If you're a Vulcan, you know, Vulcan crew member going on these ships on these long space missions, like 5 years, what have you, isn't this the sort of information that outsiders should probably know? Like, you're at least your captain. The captain and the doctor should be aware that, like, hey, this might be a problem, and this crew member may become violent.
Well, why not just look at your shore leave schedule and just, like, pick a date and hop in a shuttle if need be?
Sure.
You know, why couldn't Spock just take a shuttle back to Vulcan? You know, that was one of the big issues that was going on throughout that episode. But
I mean, it's triggered in some cases with characters in some of the ones we're going to talk about coming up, where it's not necessarily, like, the seven-year cycle, but... To me, this feels like something that's really important to know.
Yeah.
Because, you know, whether it's Spock or Tuvok, you know, these characters are very reliable and dependable. They don't shift a lot. And so if you have this person that essentially the captain can always rely on to be their rock, essentially, they should probably be aware that, hey, at some point this character is not going to be in good shape.
do you buy into the explanation that it is so unbelievably private that Vulcans don't even like talking about it amongst each other?
Yeah.
Much. Then I wonder what
I can believe that. Yeah. You know, I mean, obviously humans don't discuss a lot of things with each other also. So, I mean, I believe that Vulcans would be the same, but.
What does the Vulcan Expeditionary Group do then? Because
you don't want to know, Tyler.
But the thing is that they're all aware
yeah.
of what's going on biologically, but they don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Are they all just like fighting the whole time?
Maybe, but yeah, ritual combat.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Yeah, this brings up a lot of questions about, you know, exactly how it works. Are Vulcans only allowed to go on missions that last 7 years? Is that about the maximum amount of time?
Maybe, yeah. Or maybe like the Vulcans should really start like sending off couples on their missions.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then you really could keep it private.
That's true.
But you send, you know, these single guy, well, not single, but essentially single as in one person, like a Tuvok or a Spock into space. Well, tough luck for the rest of the crew, I guess. You know, like, yeah. And you know, look at the case of Varric and B'Elanna. He is literally transferring his Ponfar onto her through assault. That, to me, is not good.
Not cool.
Not good.
Yeah.
And I think actually starts the episode off in a way that is very hard to recover from.
Well, okay, so let's talk about maybe fixing it then. Yeah. I think Varric should have thought long ahead right. as opposed to, hey, you know what? I'm having Ponfar in about an hour.
Yeah.
I need to find a mate.
Sure.
Like, he never really thought logically about it, though, because yeah. I think logically, he should also understand that B'Elanna's probably not going to say yes to him.
I got to be honest, Varric comes across like a serial killer to me.
Oh, the entire time.
He reminds me of that serial killer, like, sniper Vulcan in Field of Fire from right. DS9. Yeah. Like,
maybe that's what his problem was. It wasn't PTSD, it was Ponfar.
There is evil in that character's eyes yeah. in a way that isn't in a character like Tuvok or Spock, where I feel more sympathy towards them.
Yeah.
You know, like Varric, I'm like, this guy's creepy.
Okay.
And I think there actually is a very simple way to fix this, and that you have this character, he's an ensign, this is the first time he's gone through Ponfar. That's scary.
Yeah.
Like, make him in a vulnerable situation where he needs help to a certain degree, but he can't talk about it. And have, I mean, B'Elanna be the character that maybe goes to comfort him in some way, and maybe just through contact, like her putting her arm around him or something, have it passed on that way through some sort of link. Like, I think you could have the ramifications of Ponfar contact without having him, like, grab her head
yeah.
violently.
Yes, because she rejected him.
Yeah, and I know originally the plan was that this was going to be a Tuvok episode. He would get the Ponfar.
Mm-hmm.
And it was rewritten to be B'Elanna because Tim Russ was like, I am not doing this episode. Like, he really had severe issues with the idea of putting Tuvok in a situation where he could theoretically be pushed towards adultery. Because he said, this is an 8 o'clock show. Tuvok is a married man with children. I do not want him put in this position.
Okay.
And so it was rewritten as a B'Elanna episode. And it took quite a long time to refine it down to what it became. And even like the Tom Paris element was added later too. That was supposed to be Tuvok helping B'Elanna. So it's interesting to me they rewrite Tuvok as the character who's more like the teacher.
Yeah.
He's the one essentially laying down the rules of how this episode is going
to
work.
Well, maybe it is a good situation for him to learn from. He's just like, well, here's a fellow Vulcan on my ship, and we're trapped on the other side of the galaxy. I'll observe how this worked out, and maybe I can figure it out for on my own a little bit down the road, which we can discuss later on. But yeah, in this situation, I think that could have worked if that's how you wanted this whole situation to play out.
Yeah.
If you wanted to avoid it altogether, I think, you know, Varric should have just been thinking way ahead. He honestly, as much as you're not supposed to talk about it amongst Vulcans,
yeah.
he should have gone to Tuvok first and talked about it. And well, then,
don't you think that would be an interesting episode? Would be to have Tuvok, who's, you know, a very experienced man, you know, he's been married, kids, he's been around for a long time, essentially like coaching a young, scared Vulcan ensign through this process.
Yeah.
I think that would actually be a really interesting episode for Tuvok.
I would have been fascinated by that.
And I was really disappointed. There's a scene where, like, he goes in and Varric is in his room, like, meditating.
Screaming at him. I wish he had a bowl of soup to throw at Tuvok.
But I was really hoping to have a scene where, like, Tuvok talks to him. You know, like, really, like, tries to convey that he understands what he's going through. And you don't really get that.
Well, and I'll just think about the dynamic of a Vulcan who is not incapacitated in any way, trying to reach out to a Vulcan who's having severe, you know, emotional issues and biological issues at this point.
Right. And to me, Tuvok, yes, I get it. Vulcans don't want to talk about this with their own, but you take a certain amount of responsibility when you become like an officer with Starfleet. And to me, that safety of the ship should take precedent. Like, I feel like Tuvok should be taking a more active role here.
But alas, Cam, we find ourselves in this situation, and Tom and B'Elanna are in an even more awkward situation.
Yeah.
And this is where I guess we get a little bit of a very problematic storyline as well, in that we have B'Elanna constantly pushing to have sex with Tom to relieve her of this issue, and he's pushing back, saying, like, I know it'll ruin our relationship.
Right.
I'll hate myself for taking advantage of you in this situation, and you'll hate me for me being the one who took advantage of you in this situation. Well, it took about, 4 minutes of screen time for him to rethink that, and then he's willing to have sex with her?
Well, I mean, after, I guess, Tuvok and Chakotay are like, well, you gotta do what you gotta do.
Yeah, okay.
It's like, okay.
To me, it's like giving him a hall pass.
Yeah.
And it's, again, more kind of icky sort of stuff.
Like, I like the sense that, like, Tom Paris, initially, in the scenes where they're in the cave together and she's going through it, is like, no, I don't want it this way. Like, this is, you know, I do have feelings for you. And he does confess it in this episode. Yeah. And I like what it does for their relationship. I mean, it's definitely a weird how did you get together story. But I like the sense that, you know, this quote-unquote bad boy Tom Paris, we're actually seeing take a moral stance on something that I think other episodes would have implied maybe he wouldn't. You know, it shows some progress towards this character and the way he views those around him. But, yeah, it does kind of turn into that. It's kind of like the show wants to have its cake and eat it, too. They want to present the situation where, you know, there's, like, this moral character making a stand and saying, no, I have to support my friend and not take advantage of her in this situation. But then it's like they also kind of want to be like, but isn't this a sexy episode? Like, it does feel like they want both.
There's attempted sex scene in the bushes was one of the least titillating things I've ever witnessed in Star Trek, which is saying a lot.
I don't know what you're talking about, Tyler.
I was just like, I was so uncomfortable watching this. I can't tell you. But I do wonder if the writers are successful at flipping the script to a certain degree, in that, like, we originally Ponfar as this Vulcan male biological urge.
Mm-hmm.
We have that going on with Vork as well. And then it's transferred to B'Elanna.
Yeah.
And so we have kind of the woman being the one who, again, I this is one of the other issues, is like, you can't be held accountable for your actions because biology is telling you need to sexually pursue people. But we do have the woman doing this at that time. So I wonder if that is one way that the writers are kind of back in the 90s sort of addressing some of the problematic elements that happened 30 years prior, where you're talking about, you know, women being of, you know, possession of a man.
Right.
But then well, Vork comes down and says, I've come to claim you. So again, it's that male sexual dominance over a woman.
Yes.
She gets to try to kick his ass, though, which is, I don't know. I guess it goes back to the problematic elements you were talking about earlier about how, you know, sex equals death amongst Ponfar.
And this scenario in itself is really, it's really uncomfortable, is the idea that she has to physically fight this guy. And like, what happens if he beats her?
Okay. The other thing that creeped me out is, did you see what his initial fighting move was?
No, I didn't notice.
Vulcan nerve pinch.
Oh, my God.
So he was going to make her unconscious.
Yeah.
And then what?
Yeah. Like, to me, that is kind of where I'm not going to say the episode goes right throughout. But I think the thing is, I feel like the episode really does dance back and forth, trying to essentially do the right thing. I know this episode was written by a writer named Lisa Klink. So it is a female perspective on this story, which I think is interesting. And
it's actually a pseudonym for Brandon Braga.
Well, okay.
Lisa Klink was one of the few female writers on staff for like an extended period of time on Voyager. I joke.
Yeah. That's a good one, though. But, you know, so I like the sense that she was putting a lot of thought. I know this episode was delayed a lot because they really wanted to get it right. They wanted to defy the expectations.
Just like a mock time was delayed because of all the potential that they saw in it.
Yeah. And, you know, Robert Duncan McNeil talked a lot about how he had a lot of concerns with the episode and really was invested strongly in making sure that the Tom Paris story, like, worked out to way he felt was fair for the characters.
Does he come off super awful in this one.
I don't think
I don't,
so.
I don't think so. I mean, there's still some icky stuff being depicted, yeah. but I actually think he comes off as well as he could in this yeah. situation.
Well, it's a situation where I actually think the two main characters going through this scenario together both come off pretty good. Like, I don't think B'Elanna Torres is doing anything wrong whatsoever. And I don't think Tom Paris is taking, like, a creepy approach either. It's just a bad situation, essentially, with these two characters stuck in it. To me, it's more like the outside events. It's really the Vorik situation and kind of just the way that, like, Chakotay and Tuvok are like, well, Tom, it's up to you.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know. Why not send over Tuvok and have him meditate with her? I mean, I get it. He's a married man. Maybe he can't do that. But it's like, there's no other options?
I know.
And I do have issues, you know, going back. You know, the idea of her having to fight Vorik off is, I get it. Like, it's awesome for a female character to have agency fighting off her attacker. Like, it'd be really lame if Tom Paris was the one fighting to protect her, yes. which is very much like a yes. nemesis situation where you had, like, Riker avenging the psychic rape of Troi. Like, that sort of stuff is, like, kind of lame. And I appreciate that a 1990s episode is doing that. It's giving B'Elanna the ability to do that. But it's hard for me to watch the episode and not be considering the whole time the ramifications of what happens if she loses.
Yeah.
And this character of Vorik, boy, he just doesn't have the lovability of a Spock where you're like, well, he's going through a tough time, but I understand this character is, at heart, a very good person or Vulcan or whatever you want to say. I don't get that sense from Vorik.
So what we've found at this point is 2 out of 2, ritual combat is the solution to Ponfar.
Yeah, and they're both healed through the violence, yeah. again, which oh. is, it's a really fascinating element of the story in the sense that, you know, Star Trek is an American TV institution, and you do have this dichotomy between sex and violence. And of course, in American media, North American, because we're Canadian, same thing kind of up here, where, like, sex is very vilified on in TV or films versus violence is very much, like, considered acceptable. And it's interesting to me, in these two American Star Trek stories, you have the solution in both cases, violence, is what yeah. stops the Ponfar.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting insight. So, mm-hmm. Well, I'm not certain it gets any better with our next episode, though, with Bounty, in right. which these microbes spark this neurochemical imbalance in T'Pol.
Yeah.
And we realize it's Ponfar. She doesn't seem nearly as private about it as others. She also starts off the very heteronormative sort of revelation that she needs to have sex with a male.
Right.
So it's saying Ponfar, it's only good if it's between male and female. So sure. already you're throwing out LGBTQ Vulcans.
I mean, Enterprise didn't have a great track record for that anyway with the episode Bound.
No, not so. At all. So that's an issue here, but I mean, let's talk about this. Okay, we can go back and forth, but I do want to skip to the end in which T'Pol makes her escape out of the decon chamber where she's quarantined with Phlox, and the crew is told she's acting irrational,
mm-hmm.
which wonderful thing to say to a woman,
of course.
And then she's literally chased down by armed men that are masked and shot.
Yeah.
In order to, quote-unquote, cure her. So, again, right. with the violence. And it's just, like, to me, the Bounty episode was probably the most problematic depiction of Ponfar. Cam, how do we fix the T'Pol situation here?
Okay. I think this is pretty much a top-to-bottom rewrite.
Okay.
I don't think there's really anything salvageable here.
This is not a fan favorite, whereas I think people can watch yeah. an episode like Blood Fever and Amok Time and take away some very memorable things from this.
Yeah.
Is anybody really paying attention to the B story here?
Yeah.
I don't think many fans are really championing this one, you know, 15 years later.
Well, I think you can, you know, look at Blood Fever and Amok Time and take really good things from them. There may be problems, or maybe you don't really care that much about the problems. You can see that there's some solid storytelling yeah. going on. Yeah. There's not solid storytelling going on in Bounty, at least not in this B story. The A story is pretty good, but the B story is really, I think, a problem and actually brings a lot of issues into the story that I think Blood Fever mostly sidesteps, which is like that real fear of female sexuality,
oh, yeah.
which was very prominent in media. I mean, it still exists, but it was much worse, I think, before, you know, our current era. And it really does kind of demonize it to a sense. And, like, there's nothing scarier than this, like, female sexuality unleashed. And I think B'Elanna, they find a good way to deal with it where you have her having conversations with Tom Paris about it. Like, it's two characters communicating through a problem. Whereas the T'Pol situation, it kind of just turns her into like a porn fantasy for the show, because they've got her in the decon chamber, which we already know what the decon chamber was invented for, and that's to create sexy situations on Star Trek.
Yeah.
This was actually the last time they used the decon chamber, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Wonder why.
Yeah, but you know, you're putting her there in this very like skimpy clothing, covered in fake sweat, and it's like, okay, now she's just like
and the doctor are doing jelly back rubs with each other.
Yeah, and then she's just like aggressively coming on to him throughout, and then to every male character, and it's just kind of icky. Like, I know Enterprise often gets a little bit of criticism, I think often rightfully so, for being kind of like a bro-tastic Star Trek series, where you have like Archer and Trip and Reed making these kind of comments sometimes, and it is kind of like the dudes looking out for dudes on the ship, and you have your most your strongest female character is a Vulcan on the ship who's an outsider. She isn't even a member of the crew. And so it does create a little bit of them versus me situation. So, and I think this really does make this exhibit of like female sexuality like an other.
Yes.
An other that has to be taken down with violence.
Well, again, conquered by the men. It's literally five men in masks conquering her.
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, dear. So do we see potential in the preceding two episodes, but we think this one is, I guess, unsalvageable in its depiction? And do we learn really anything about Ponfar other than it's a very heteronormative experience according to the Vulcans?
Like, no, I mean, the only thing we learn is that this was the first time we'd seen a Vulcan female go through it, which I think is actually...
That's true. Okay, yeah.
And I think there's something to that. Like, that's a thing. I think Enterprise actually had the opportunity to tell a really interesting story that may have held up better.
Well, I wonder if, like, Ponfar for a woman... Okay, A, was it ever established that it's anything beyond just a male biological condition? Because I think what happened here is like these microbes triggered this neurochemical reaction.
Correct,
My assumption still is like it's something that hits Vulcan males every 7 years, not necessarily women. So whatever, I think it did open up the door for like an interesting different story about how this woman is maybe able to conquer it in a way that doesn't involve ritual combat.
Right.
You know, that's a very different sort of story. I wonder if this could have been a woman knows how to deal with Ponfar much better than a man does. And I think that could have, you know, been kind of a progressive story for Star Trek to tell as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I just think this was a really great opportunity to give T'Pol a really interesting story. Because she is very much positioned on the show as, like, your female Spock. Like, she is on, you know, like, the first Vulcan hanging out with a crew in space. Like, why not tell that story with a certain amount of dignity? Especially, like, 40 years later. Like, the opportunity is there to do something interesting. It seems like they were not interested. Like, they just saw it as a way to sort of just shoehorn in, like, sexy female violence.
It felt like they're just checking a box for obligatory Ponfar episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one notable thing, though, is we saw Spock throwing soup out of his room.
Yeah.
We saw T'Pol devouring her salad.
That's true.
So that's a difference between the men and women when it comes to Ponfar.
Yeah. Do you think they would have ever considered doing a proper Ponfar episode?
I think maybe Manny Coto,
he
could have done something interesting with that. And I hope it would have been, I guess, a bit of a revamp of Ponfar.
Okay.
I hope he would have... I haven't really cracked the code, and like, because there's so many problematic elements. Just the fundamental idea is like men cannot be blamed for their biological urges.
Right.
We even have Spock disobeying orders and doesn't even remember, you know, changing the course of the ship.
Yeah, or like Vorik. I mean, that guy would have been kicked off my ship.
I know. So I wonder... Okay, as iconic as it is, Cam, is it true that it's something of its era where it doesn't quite translate to progressive audiences nowadays?
Well, I think ultimately, yes, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. Like, it was a storytelling device used in a 1960s TV series, and I think introduced an interesting aspect of Vulcan mythology. But I think the idea is you got to build on it. Like, you know, take that initial episode premise and find other ways to develop it and make it more nuanced throughout the franchise. And I don't know that they ever really did. I feel like they just kept... Like, to me, when I look at these Ponfar episodes, these central Ponfar episodes, the 60s one shouldn't feel like the most sensitive one.
I know.
And it does, by a long shot.
That's so bizarre.
Yeah. Like, to me, that should not be the end game. That should be the beginning of telling these stories and making them... Like, I get it. Like, they put a lot of effort into Blood Fever. And, you know, I know a lot of them are very proud of that episode. And I actually think the episode... Boy, it's got a lot of problems. But I actually can appreciate, essentially, the sincerity in which they approached it.
I agree.
Yeah.
You know? To me, it's not the same kind of garbage water as the T'Pol storyline.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel like they've ever figured out a way to tell that story in a way that felt like they were evolving the idea of what a Ponfar story is. At least not to a degree that feels like a real watershed moment for the franchise.
My big concern, though, is that because I think it's kind of a fundamentally flawed sort of cultural characteristic tied to biology, that if Discovery ever approaches it, they're not going to address that central issue there, where men cannot be blamed for what their biology tells them to do.
Right.
And so I don't want to see Ponfar depicted on screen in Star Trek, but I'm wondering if there could be offhanded remarks or references to it or something that addresses some of the what if there's a, I don't know, a diplomatic meeting that Sark is needed at, and there's a very coy explanation, but you know he's off at Ponfar, and that's why he can't make it. Like, something like that, I think, would be kind of the best-case scenario. I just don't know how they solve this fundamental problem here that I've been talking about.
I know Kurtzman and Orsi were thinking about putting in some references to it in the 2009 Star Trek,
mm-hmm.
and then they were like, no, we're going to save that for later.
Okay, and still waiting. save it for 7 years.
Well, Orsi can keep saving it as long as he wants. But it does raise the question of, like, you know, what is going on in the life of, like, Spock in the Kelvinverse? Because, you know, we're coming up, I think, to a time era where he would experience this.
I think, okay, so...
I know the timeline is all over the place.
I think he would have already experienced this on his time on the ship, so... although, okay, let me do the math backwards on Amok time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not, then. I don't know. It's tough. No, because then he would have been under Pike at a certain point.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
He would have experienced it at some point.
Yeah, like on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
So, okay, maybe that's what the Enterprise 1701 mashup with Discovery is going to be all about. The danger is, like, Spock's missing. Where'd he go?
Oh.
On far.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And then 7 years later, we've got Amok time. The timeline would actually work out, I think.
Okay.
Thereabouts. I could be off by a year or two, but yeah. There you go. Discovery writers, I'll wait for that royalty check anytime now.
I want to talk a little bit about the use of it in Star Trek III.
Yeah, okay.
The Search for Spock, which to me is the most interesting in how it's handled, and it's very vague. I don't think a lot of audience members who aren't Star Trek fans would even know what's going on.
I remember the first time I saw it.
Yeah?
I wasn't super familiar with Ponfar.
Yeah.
I was just like, Savick's banging Spock, a very young Spock for some reason.
Did that occur to you?
Yeah.
You see, that flew over my head when I first saw it. I was just like, I guess they're just meditating or something.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Because it shows them, like, touching hands, and I was like, okay, I guess. Honestly, when I saw that movie, I knew nothing about Vulcans, really.
Yeah.
So to me, it's like, well, I guess they have some sort of magical power.
So at that point, do you think that, I don't know, this is the best depiction of Ponfar, in that it's left very vague? We don't have all those problematic elements, and we also don't have, like, a woman who, I mean, she's doing this through her own agency. We don't have a woman who's being conquered by the male.
Right. But it also repositions what Ponfar even is, because this Spock is not trying to take a mate at this age.
I think he doesn't even know what's going on, right?
No, he doesn't.
Yeah.
How old is he around this point? This is more like puberty. I feel like way the movie is dealing with it.
I think this is like 21-year-old
Spock. Is it 21? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. I'd be horrified if it was like 12-year-old Spock.
Yeah.
So, I think that might be the best depiction of Ponfar that we've seen on Star Trek.
Yeah.
There's two other examples maybe we want to talk about very briefly on Star Trek Voyager. But first, the Doctor... is having a daydream in Tinker Tenor Dr. Spy.
Yeah.
And he envisions one Tuvok being overcome with emotions and laughing his ass
and
off
laughing,
and all that. How do you like the Doctor's daydream? Like, the Doctor doesn't really know that much about Ponfar.
Right.
So he's just imagining what maybe Vulcans are going through. I think this actually gives credence to what you're saying with regards to the Chapel and Spock interaction, where
right.
it's very much about like lowering your guard to a certain degree. And right. You have no control over your emotions.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a lot of fun. And I like the idea of Ponfar presented, and especially Tuvok's emotional reactions to Ponfar, presented through an outsider who sees it in very broad, cartoony terms. Like, mm-hmm. to me, it's kind of very amusing in a comedic episode to see someone view it this way. Although, I don't know that a hologram really would view it that way, but it's pretty amusing.
Yeah, it's the way that they did not take it in a mock time.
Right.
And that they're just kind of making a joke out of it.
Yeah.
So... And finally, let's talk about when Tuvok goes through Ponfar.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is all kind of off screen. It's not really depicted head on. I'm incredibly disappointed with the storyline.
In the episode Body and Soul?
Yeah, there's so many opportunities for us to do something interesting with the character. The fans knew going into this show, just based on the premise of Star Trek Voyager, that Tuvok was going to have to deal with Ponfar at one point.
Yeah.
Instead, we've got Tom make him a hologram,
yeah.
which didn't work with Vorek.
Yeah.
Is the only explanation here is that Tuvok's gone through it enough times that maybe he knows how to make a hologram work for him?
I mean, maybe, because they do say that Vorek, this is his first time.
Yeah.
So, okay, I can believe that maybe he's just really has no control over himself. Like, Tuvok is a character who I think often to the agony of the viewer has a lot of control over himself
sure.
at all times throughout the entirety of that series for the most part.
I don't think Jolene Blaylock was studying his reel when she did her own research for T'Pol.
No.
Yeah.
But I think the zombie Vulcans were, though, in that episode. But what I like is the idea of, like, what does a married Vulcan do when he's going through Ponfar in this sort of situation? Like, I like that element. Unfortunately, for Tuvok and for, I guess, us viewers who want to maybe explore this issue, this is a B story wedged into a really, really strong 7 of 9 episode where they are giving her massive amounts of screen time. So it's really wedged into like 3 scenes.
Yeah.
And so we are not getting a particularly nuanced, layered look at Tuvok going through this. And I actually think it's a really interesting response to Tim Russ fighting about putting Tuvok in the Blood Fever episode, saying, I'm a married man on the show, and I don't want to have Tuvok in a situation of wanting to commit adultery. And I think it's interesting that, you know, 4 seasons later, we're going to that Tuvok story, and it almost seems like they're following Tim Russ's notes.
I know.
And I kind of like that. Like, I like that the actor is putting them in a situation where they have to tell this story through the lens of what Tuvok would do.
But I just don't know if it was executed in a way that was interesting at all.
No, it's not. That's the problem. It's actually really boring. Yeah. Because ultimately, yeah, the doctor's techniques don't work. And so, yeah, it's a holodeck program of his wife.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. He says the Vulcan libido increases with age in this episode. So wouldn't it become
so
more
does
uncontrollable?
The Tyler libido, Cam.
Yeah. Oh, my. But, I mean, wouldn't that make the Ponfar more uncontrollable?
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, you know what? If you have this story with Spock in, say, like one of the films, not that they would ever do that, but...
That's what the Quentin Tarantino movie is going to be.
Old Spock, though.
Yeah.
I mean, the issue is, I have no problem watching Body and Soul and believing that Tuvok could cure himself like this. Because
I know.
Such a wet blanket of a character, for the most part, that, like, yes, I believe he could meditate it away, or in this case... meet a facsimile of his wife on the holodeck, and yeah, it's over. Problem solved. But it does raise the question of, like, you know, Tuvok's a bright guy. Why was this not an idea that popped into his head earlier?
Well, I mean, he did tell the doctor there's only 3 possibilities here.
Yeah.
I guess holograms... I don't know how long holograms have been around for.
Right.
That's probably not what the ancient Vulcans used, so maybe that's why his mind was stuck in that. And he didn't really have enough, you know, many people on the ship to bounce ideas off of.
Right.
I don't think Vorek wanted to bring it up again, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does raise an interesting question to me, though, and that kind of looping back to what, you know, you were saying right at the start of this episode, really, about the 1960s episode setting up the rules for how Ponfar operates and this idea of them having to duel for a woman. I mean, as science fiction fans, like, we love rules. We want to hear the rules to how these things operate because it allows us to essentially follow along with what the characters are going to do and take part in their decision-making. But is Pon Farr a situation where you almost don't want these really hardcore rules hammered into stone?
And I think if we go back to Star Trek III, when they left it vague, I think that was actually the best way that they depicted it.
Yeah.
So I agree. Yeah, it's like, I think kind of the rules written in stone is actually what made Pon Farr more problematic than anything else.
And I think gave the writers of these future series more roadblocks in terms of how to tell this story. Like, if you only have got a very, very, very set number of solutions to the problem, it's kind of like, well, what do we do?
That's why I said, like, Discovery, just skip it. Don't even touch on it. Because, like you said, there's only three solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they wrote themselves into a corner with T'Pol and Enterprise and realized, well, we don't actually have a solution for this.
Do you think it's possible, though, to have a Star Trek series where you have a Vulcan as a main character on your show and not do that story? Like, do you think it's just so irresistible to a creative staff running a Star Trek show? And look, Discovery can totally sidestep this. They don't need that Sarek story or that Vulcan Admiral story.
Yeah.
But another Star Trek series or film or something, I think with a Vulcan character, may feel a lot more like they have to.
I agree.
And is there a way to reposition it? Like,
I think it's fundamentally flawed. And I think the best way you can address it is by being vague about it. And you just can't include those very gross kind of elements about, like, A, like, possession of a woman, and then B, like, kind of the sexual dominance over a woman, which is very pervasive throughout all these depictions of Pon Farr.
It's too bad that actually the 24th century Trek, the Berman era, and Voyager specifically, didn't take the opportunity to say Vulcan society has changed over the last 100-plus years. Like, we've changed the way that we deal with Pon Farr. Like, I actually think that would be an interesting way to go, and they kind of painted themselves into a corner by saying, nope, it's the same as in the 1966 Star Trek series.
Yeah, I know. I look, if you got, like, 100 years to fix this problem, I don't think Discovery is going to be the outlet to fix Pon Farr.
Maybe not
the Captain Picard spinoff. Yeah.
Captain Picard solves Pon Farr.
Yeah.
That would be an amazing episode.
It's the pilot.
Make it so.
It's Patrick Stewart wrote it.
Okay, well, I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod.
Yeah, so Cam, if people also want to find even more Cameron out and about on the internets, what's another good spot to do that?
Yes, you can head over to arniegeddon.com or find the Arnie Geddon podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and all the podcasting apps. It's the Arnold Schwarzenegger film discussion, where I get together with Tony G every 2 weeks and tackle an Arnold Schwarzenegger film. And I think we're going to be doing diversion episodes coming up where we tackle, you know, like ranking lists and that sort of stuff. But there's an episode, I think right now, we've got Killing Gunther and Running Man in the most recent ones. And we just recorded Twins the other night, which, boy, 1988 in film, that is the epitome of it right there.
Can't wait until Triplets.
Yeah, no kidding. Oh, there's plenty of talk about Triplets on the episode, too.
Well, and for all those that might be going to the Star Trek Las Vegas convention in August, Cam and I, we will be there. We're going to be presenting a panel on the evolution of storytelling on Star Trek. We're going to be talking about serialization, where Discovery fits in now. And I think because, look, it's the 25th anniversary of Deep Space Nine, we're going to get in a lot of Deep Space Nine talk, especially with how Deep Space Nine really got this jump started with regards to serialized storytelling. We're going to have a lot of fun up on stage, and I'd encourage, if you guys see us around, just say hi. We've done that in previous years. It's always great talking to listeners, so keep it up.
Definitely. Now, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Cameron, it's our 200th episode spectacular, and we're going to tackle an episode I cannot believe we've never done before at all during this podcast, the best episodes of Star Trek. We've done, like, the best worst episodes.
Yeah.
We've done best episodes featuring transporter accidents.
Yep. Space madness.
Don't get me started on that one. But
check the archives for space madness.
Yeah. I think the closest we've come is like the best desert island episodes.
Yeah.
This is you and I sitting down and hashing out what are unequivocally, no arguments. It's not subjective at all.
No.
It's all objective fact. what are the best episodes of Star Trek, and I'm already just like crying my eyes out trying to like narrow down the list, figure it out, have like a solid representation of the
animated series,
the franchise. Yeah, you know. But you know what, I'm just gonna go with my gut instincts. I think eventually that's what's going to lead me the way. I haven't figured it out yet, and
well, it's very
wait.
Tough because you got to decide, like, am I including all the five episodes considered by most the greatest episodes of all time?
I know. And so, you know, there's lists you can look at, but there's some lists. And honestly, like, I know for a fact, like, there's going to be maybe a few omissions where people are like, how come? You're obviously not a Star Trek fan. How is that not on your list? And I'm like, well, it's not what makes Star Trek great to me, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, we're going to have fun with this one, Cam. And maybe we can reflect a little bit on just 200 episodes of doing this show. And I think it'll be fun. Maybe you can play a clip of our first 5 minutes of our episode number one, Cam. That'll be horrifying for everybody involved.
But then they won't know that I'm on the episode.
I know. Just Tyler talking and talking. Although, what else is new?
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vorik. Problematic character, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTON. N as in, well, need a ditch pon far.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.